That's nice.
Yeah.
Oh, marvelous. I didn't know that. Yeah, super.
Yeah, so his name is still there, and it's funny because
you know,
he did
opiate medicinal chemistry.
I do. No, I thought you were taking me all the way back to the Dutch. And I thought, oh dear, oh no. No, but I expected
I'll be
more
equally
people
ambiguous as
would,
we get further into this.
I expected more people would bring him up to me once they heard that I was from Rensselaer.
Sure.
And you know I would love to hear, you know, reminiscences. What I'd like from you, actually, is all the stuff you didn't put in that lecture. Go ahead and reminisce. You know, tell me what it's been like to be in this field, how you got into the field, what attracted you to the problem of addiction.
I will put a lot of that into the written part of the speech, so it'll be there. And I can tell you a little bit about it too, if you'd like.
Well, don't repeat things that I'm going to have access to in terms of written work, but you know.
I can't. Since I don't have a final draft of it, I can't be sure.
Yes.
I'll give you an abbreviated form. I did very straightforward experimental psychology with an emphasis on operant conditioning when I was at the University of Virginia. And I got into a bit of an intellectual squabble with some of the people who were my teachers at Virginia, and they were a little inhibiting on the kind of work that we that I wanted to do. So I decided to do a bit of rebellion to begin with, and then I decided that for some reason or other they had control. And so I did what they wanted me to do and got out as fast as I could. And and partly as a consequence of doing those things and being interested in operant conditioning, I decided I wanted to do something that I considered to be reasonably practical. I had done some very theoretical work for my thesis research, and I wanted to do something that I thought I could explain to someone other than my thesis advisor what I was up to. So when Bob Schuster hired me at University of Michigan as a research assistant, and I made the connection not directly to him, but through a friend of mine who was a graduate student at the University of Michigan, who actually searched Schuster out. It would have been fairly hard for me to recognize that he was there, since I was totally in a different field. And he had just moved from Maryland to the University of Michigan, was setting up a lab when I arrived. So I was a little apprehensive because I had heard a little bit about drug research, and I read about it, but I didn't really know anything about pharmacology at all.
So why were you apprehensive?
Apprehensive because I was changing fields, moving into a different academic department, and leaving my discipline behind to some significant extent. It turned out that I enjoyed learning pharmacology by doing pharmacology. And it was fun, just a lot of fun. And it was a very exciting time to be there because techniques for training and researching animals taking drugs was just starting. And it had been started by three different groups, really. A fellow who was a Michigan pharmacology graduate by the name of Jim Weeks had done the early work in rats and had made a couple of, made a report in Science and also had a very early Scientific American article on drug self-administration. And that was a very interesting paper because in addition there were pictures of these monkeys that were taking drugs at Michigan, and I couldn't figure out what the connection was because he was at Kalamazoo and these monkeys were in Ann Arbor, and the connection between them wasn't made clear in the article. And it turned out that that was a laboratory that had been put together by Maurice Severs and Tomoji Yanagida and Jerry Deneau, three pharmacologists in the department. But I was hired by Bob Schuster. Bob Schuster was a psychologist by training, and Severs was smart enough to know that that psychology was going to have something to say about these kinds of things.
Was Severs still around at the
time?
Oh
yeah, oh yeah. He was big time. Yes. he had already been president of the Pharmacology Society and was a senior statesman for pharmacologists throughout the world, really. Especially in Japan, and he was he was a first order of rising sun in Japan, which was a very high honor for him, and any non-Japanese person at that time. So he had a very strong connection to Japan, and having Dr. Yanagida in Ann Arbor for a significant period of time was a big help to him.
Why was it through Yanagida that he became known in Japan, or how did that connection happen?
No, he was a consultant to the Japanese government after the Second World War when they had a methamphetamine epidemic. And he became known throughout Japan at the time because he suggested some things to them that were very important in curbing the epidemic. and it was given a lot of credit for doing so.
Yes. He also was did you know that he consulted in the States for curbing the heroin epidemic in the early 50s in New York City?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's where I first ran into him and realized that he, although a pharmacologist, was being brought into this social milieu and, you know, as an expert.
Yes.
So but I didn't realize he had been in Japan doing that.
when exactly, right after the Second World War, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But we could find out. let's see. So to bring it back to me, there's something else to say though about him. He throughout his career had been interested in the effects of drugs of abuse in animals. He, during the Second World War, had studied cannabinoids, uh, at that time nobody knew anything about receptors or endogenous ligands for marijuana, but they knew about marijuana, they knew about ways of making stiffer kinds of marijuana. And he studied those things there and had people in the department who did. He, as a graduate student, had studied morphine and cocaine in animals and done some of the first observational studies on behavioral effects of them at the University of Chicago. So he was very, very interested in addiction.
What do you think drew him to it?
Well, I don't know. Often there are family issues and things of that sort. People, significant others and the histories of the families that draw people in. It wasn't that in his case, at least not to my knowledge. I'm not sure. It could have been that he was a very smart man, and he chose an interesting niche to emphasize a way of making his department different. And it was world-renowned, and at the time, it was probably easily one of the most influential departments in the country.
Along with
Hopkins and Harvard. He routinely supplied chairs to medical school departments of pharmacology throughout the country. It was a well-known secret that the way you became a chair in pharmacology was to go to the University of Michigan, be an assistant professor, and then go on and build your own nest. But there was a really significant influence of within the department through him of studies of drugs of abuse, and that continued for long after he retired.
And what about him and Schuster? What was that relationship like?
Schuster was there for a fairly short period of time.
Six years?
Maybe about that, yeah. Maybe not that long, actually. I think he left in 69 or something like that. And he came in 64. So maybe 5 or 6. Severs ran the department in a thoroughly authoritarian way for what he wanted to accomplish, and the things he didn't want to deal with, the committee he formed committees to handle everything. He was on Nixon's commission on the war on drugs. He thoroughly enjoyed that. He did that after he retired. That was a commission. I wrote a report for an addendum to that report to the president or to the country, whatever they say about those things. let's see.
So his relationship with Schuster was.
He was just a good boss. he had a lot of, they had a considerable mutual respect for each other. They were very different kind of people, very, very different kind of people. But I think one of the things that Bob respected and took from his association with Sievers was a sincere respect for science administration and with the issues associated with policy that can grow from scientific issues around things for which policy issues have to be decided.
Yeah, so Sievers clearly was policy involved.
All the time.
He never saw himself as a pure scientist in that.
Not really. I mean, he did some things early in his career that he respected rigorous science and did what he could do to have high standards of that kind in the department. And so if anything was a little shaggy, it wouldn't hesitate to tell you so. And you didn't take anything to him to tell him something new going on in the lab if it was shaky. people who did got in trouble all the time. Other members of the department would do that. We would do it. We'd hear about it. There's interesting history for you in the minutes of the Committee on Problems of Drug Dependence, which are written up in the National Academy back in the in Nathan Bietti's book, and in the notes that I have read in the 50s, early 50s, late 50s, in which a lot of the minutes are taken and individuals are indicated in them as to what comments they made and things of that sort. They used to argue a lot. It was a lot of fun to read some of the things about which they argue.
Why were you reading them?
Well, I took over sometime, I've forgotten exactly when. Sievers had a relationship with the committee that had to do with evaluating abuse liability of narcotics, and he did so in rhesus monkeys, and he used the ability of drugs to pharmacologically substitute for morphine in sustaining physical dependence. Part of his interest in self-administration is that he thought that there was more to, he thought that through self-administration he could get to other aspects of drug abuse than what he was currently doing. And he saw the self-administration techniques as being important to do so. He didn't know exactly how to do it.
Right. So how would you describe what he was doing? I mean, was that physical dependence separate from self-administration?
Yes.
So the conceptual shift that self-administration represents, could you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. That was something that grew out of the findings of the self-administration work. At for example, there was a considerable amount of confusion about the role of physical dependence in establishing and maintaining narcotic self-administration. And one of the first experiments that Bob and I did was to reduce the reinforcing dose of morphine to the smallest possible amount that we could maintain and check to see if the animals were dependent. In fact, we found out that we could maintain self-administration of morphine at doses below those that were necessary to induce significant physical dependence. that was revelatory at the time.
Yeah.
and essentially represented a way of suggesting that that physical dependence was not necessary for the reinforcing effects of narcotics. It could augment the reinforcing effects. That's still not clear exactly how that occurs. But you can divorce things better than adding them back sometimes. So that was important. It was also important to broaden the scope of the ways in which narcotics were evaluated. And I participated in that. I took over the abuse liability evaluation for narcotics from a junior person, Julian Villarreal.
Yes.
Who was hired onto the faculty about the same time that I was. And we were very good friends and worked together a bit before he returned to Mexico. And when he did, soon thereafter, I took over the morphine-dependent monkeys and drug evaluation for the Committee on Problems of Drug Dependence and added things to it at that time and added more things to it as we moved on.
Right. What were your relations like with Everett May and his group and the ARC?
I'm not sure exactly when this happened either, but we could check. It's in the archives somewhere. Arthur Jacobson was the biological coordinator for the Drug Evaluation Committee when I started. And I don't remember when he took it over from Everett May. That's what I don't remember. Everett hired Arthur to the Medicine and Chemistry section of NIDDK. I think that was the designation for the institute at the time. And then there was a considerable amount of time before it was headed up by a Swiss guy by the name of Arnold Brassi for a while before Kenner took over the section. But Kenner was hired. Maybe in the late '60s. To fill a position. So our relationship with them was a working relationship, and we also did some we started doing science collaboration with them, have continued to through the years. Kenner has been absolutely necessary for my science. He provides me with all kinds of compounds that I can't get otherwise. Mm-hmm. And he's just marvelous. He makes compounds for me I can't get. All I have to do is tell him why I'm interested in these, off to the running.
Yeah.
He's absolutely delightful.
Yes.
Vital resource. So we've had a real strong relation. Now, who?
The ARC.
ARC. The ARC at that time was run by William Martin when it was still in Lexington. Mm-hmm. And Martin was a real, he had an absolutely broad intellectual scope. He's an incredibly broad intellectual scope. He could do experimental therapeutics well. He could do clinical pharmacology well. He dabbled in receptor theory very intelligently, and had novel ideas about everything, all of those levels of research. He was just he was really a remarkable man, I think many the better people knew him, the more they appreciated his scientific acumen. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't get enough of him. I loved listening to him, talking to him, serving on committees with him, and things. We had a good time together.
And you went there?
No, I didn't. I sent students there for postdocs and things of that sort, and. and then Bill decided to stay on when the ARC moved to Baltimore. He stayed in Lexington and stayed in pharmacology at the university for a couple of years before he had his accident. During the time that there was a very vital and very strong relationship associated with the way we evaluated abuse liability of drugs. And the ARC played a vital role because they were evaluating the same drugs that we evaluated in monkeys. If they looked interesting in the monkey, then they were candidates, as determined by Nathan Eddy, for...
He was the one who made the...
Well, he didn't make the decision because it was obviously, it was Martin's decision, but Nathan influenced him to and persuaded him that there was a profile of action that was worthwhile for them to study. And then, of course, it was Martin's decision final decision as to what would be done. So often when we would come to these meetings, we would have new data in monkeys, and we didn't know what the people, what the studies in people were to be, and we found out at the meeting whether our results were discordant or supported mm-hmm. each other, what the differences were in evaluation of compounds, and it was really exciting. The first meeting I went to of this organization was in Lexington, and Schuster and I went, and we reported on what I just told you about the role of dependence, and we also reported some other kind of work that was interesting as well. And I gave my first presentation to the meeting, and it was in a lecture hall at the University of Kentucky. And there was a very famous psychiatrist by the name of Abe Wickler, who had appointments at the ARC and at University of Kentucky, and I didn't know who he was, and I gave my talk, and it was about something that he was very interested in. And he came up in front of the I thought to ask a question, but he came up in front of the podium and turned around to face the audience and gave a speech after my talk, some of which was relevant to my talk and some of which wasn't. But I thought that I certainly thought that I had been preempted by a famous man. I didn't find out who it was until after he finished. That was fun. And certainly something I remember.
Boy, almost everybody has a story about their first encounter with Abe Wickler.
Let's see. What else would you like to know about? Where do you want to go?
Can you tell me a little bit about, did you get a feel for how research questions, et cetera, were generated at Lexington versus how they were generated at Michigan? I mean, was there similarity, difference?
There was a little tension between them, and a little bit of intellectual sparring. That was very nice. It was very productive. I didn't perpetuate that when I got into some sort of quasi role as a leader of the Wolverine Cry. I thought it was sort of silly. That was definitely the case when we started. And I was completely taken, actually, by Martin's theoretical work. And I thought it was so important that we should just do what we could to fill in the things that were easy and important for us to do to support multiple kinds of opiate receptors in monkeys.
So it was the multiple opiate receptor hypothesis that you particularly...
That became my call, and what I wanted to spend a lot of time doing. And I still work on it. not as much as I did in the 70s, early 80s, but... a lot, nevertheless.
Yeah.
So it's been to me. It ranks in terms of scientific importance at the top of the list. I think in the long run, it'll probably be more interesting than scientifically and conceptually than endogenous opiates or opiate peptides or recognition sites for opiates or things of that sort. That's something that I reminisce about, speculate a bit about in the written form of the Eddie Award talk. we have a significant intellectual heritage to the ARC and to Bill Martin especially. It is the case that in behavioral pharmacology, receptor theory is being exploited, defined, worked out, probably better than just about anything.
That was going to be my next question.
Of that kind, in terms of theory and theoretical applications to pharmacology in general, and because it has been worked out more thoroughly, it's essentially pace setting for the understanding of other kinds of receptors in terms of the principles that are set forth that will be the same principles will work for other kinds of receptors, and they can compare, people can compare, for example, dopamine receptors to opiate receptors and find out differences and similarities to this in the ways that they work. That's one of the reasons why Martin's speculations about those things are so incredibly important. Historically and conceptually to this day.
Right, right. So you really see that work as foundational.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you think that the ARC and the work that was being done at Lexington is generally given its due?
Yeah, I think so.
So you don't see, I ask because, well, the state of behavioral pharmacology is interesting given the sort of rising of, I mean, clearly there was a paradigm shift of some sort, a conceptual shift that you all were part of. Mm-hmm. And there's been a sort of rising of neurobiology for, mm-hmm. you know, want
sure.
a sort mm-hmm. of term. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that neurobiology has sort of eclipsed behavioral pharmacology, or how would you tell that story?
Well, no, that's a very interesting interesting set of things to talk about. Behavioral pharmacology has some very interesting problems of one kind or another, and it lives with them well. I started a behavioral pharmacology division of ASPET, and I had a hard time getting it started. Because there aren't enough behavioral pharmacologists to make up a division. Mm-hmm. it's a platoon, maybe, or a couple of squads here and there. And yet, for example, neuropharmacology is the biggest division within the pharmacology society. But some of the broader pharmacologists that can entertain the possibility that both kinds of things may be interesting enjoy behavioral pharmacology because the people in it are live wires.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be because there's so few of them. Go down the tube otherwise. and in many ways that same kind of relationship exists with neurobiology in the face of neuropharmacology, because neuropharmacologists are a small batch when it comes time to go to a neuroscience meeting, they get swamped very easily. Pharmacological things, even though they're clearly vital and important, they don't get their just due that way because there's too many people who want to be neuroscientists, neurobiologists, or whatever, who want to play with genes and molecular, all things molecular. And only a few who are interested in using the techniques of molecular biology to work out problems that are have their focus in behavior disorders or they're directly expressed in behavior. Mm-hmm. So that will always be I see no end to that tension. Mm-hmm. And I see I participated in a very interesting group with the umbrella organization for experimental biology. So I forgot the name of the organization, but at any rate, I can edit it in when the time comes. Yeah. But this committee had to do with the future for integrative types of scientists and whether they could be worked into pharmacology departments, because pharmacology departments are hiring molecular biologists or people who are very interested in molecular approaches to pharmacology. And to the exclusion of what some people think are integrative sciences and behavioral pharmacology is always on the edge of being integrative, and that's what I was going to tell you. Because if we go back to the other part of behavioral pharmacology, it rests very strongly in the experimental analysis of behavior, which is Skinnerian psychology, which has always been dealt with by academic psychologists as a nasty thing that you put in a closet, especially when the neighbors come. So so they're small in number and treated like orphans.
And why is
some
that?
Ways. I think that I think it's something that comes from sometimes just intellectual prejudice. Mm-hmm. There's a way of thinking that is associated with molecular approaches to things that says that you can't deal with it because you're not dealing with the roots of the problem, and the roots of the problem are molecular, not behavioral. And there are arguments about that today, as there have been in the past about addiction. So it's not any different than the kinds of arguments that you have with other sorts of things, where there are behavioral components to disease, and people don't want to admit that there's something there to be studied. And it's probably more obvious that it is the case that there is a basis, a behavioral basis for things to be studied in addiction than some other things. That's one of the reasons why behavioral pharmacology has been as successful as it has been in the study of addiction.
Can you tell me when you think you remember seeing that tension emerge between the molecular and the integrative? I mean, when would you... You didn't necessarily come in
as a... What I was going to tell you, but let me finish one thing before we get into that. This committee had the charge of, let's find out what the current status of people's interest in doing more integrative work, because clearly people need it. They needed it. The pharmaceutical industry needs more integrative scientist types in cardiovascular, CNS, every aspect of drug development. And and there was a very interesting parting of the waves, because we asked chairs if they were interested in hiring integrative pharmacologists, and nobody was interested in hiring them. So the answer is they're going to be orphans for a while in the future. Mm-hmm. Because pharmacology chairs can't get their fill of molecular pharmacologists. Mm-hmm. So they can't create space for them. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting problem.
Yeah.
Very interesting problem.
So what was the beginnings of that?
It has been, it goes back before me. So it's a long, long, long time thing. I recognize it right off the bat. When I came in, I didn't know it psychology, because there isn't anything of that sort within. There are differences that I recognized when I was a graduate student in psychology between so-called hard-nosed type, experimental types, and soft-headed clinicians, and that sort of thing. But not in terms of molecular things versus other kinds of psychology. That of course has spread, because there are a lot of psychologists now who would just as soon call themselves neuroscientists and take strong neurochemical kinds of approaches to problems that they're interested in.
This integrative piece, do you have concerns about the reproduction of the field? I mean, do you think that's the issue?
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. If we had... we could easily have tenfold more behavioral pharmacologists, and they would have more than adequate problems to work on. They wouldn't be stepping on each other's toes by any stretch. And it would be absolutely delightful to have 10 times as many, from my point of view. And I would hope that tenfold would beget tenfold. It wouldn't be any problem. We're held back from advancing because there aren't enough. Mm-hmm. Simply aren't enough. Hmm.
All right. Let's talk about clearly, NIDA does a great deal of your funding, et cetera. Yeah. When you think about the health of the field, do you think, and think about the sort of research priorities and how they're set within NIDA, does that explain why there, I mean, how do you diagnose this sort of problem with the reproduction of the field of behavioral pharmacology?
NIDA has done an enormous amount for behavioral pharmacology, enormous amount. There's a long history to it, and it goes back to at least the beginnings of me in the 60s and before the place was an institute, it was a center. And because of the success that we've had in working with various aspects of addiction and working with it behaviorally, with human behavioral pharmacology and preclinical behavioral pharmacology, it works. And the Institute has recognized that. I would say that that kind of support actually continues. There are changes afoot that go to the tensions that we've talked about with molecular approaches that are very just as strong in the Institute as they are in other places now. So, I think that the Institute continues to fund good behavioral pharmacology, and they will in the future. I can't see why they wouldn't. So I don't see that as a problem. I see it as a bigger problem in other parts of the field, actually, NIMH, even to some extent in the Alcohol Institute, where behavioral pharmacology hasn't made as big a dent as it should have. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why. I don't know as much about it, but it seems to me that it is a significant issue because there aren't enough. There aren't enough good people.
You were important in the formation of ISGDAR. And at the time, did it seem different to you within CPDD? I mean, was there a time when behavioral pharmacology wasn't as established as it now is within this organization? Mm. I mean, was that, why did you help to?
Well, I didn't feel as strongly about it as some of my colleagues because I thought that there was quite adequate programmatic attention to behavioral pharmacology in the committee and the scientific meeting. But I must admit that over the years, it's one of the more delightful meetings because it's like-minded people get together to talk about things in a fairly intensive but informal way. Mm-hmm. And it's delightful. Mm-hmm. Looking back on it, my lack of enthusiasm is something I just assume disregard.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
But I was in on the beginning of it, and I supported it. but not enthusiastically, I must admit. It was a mistake on my part. It's really a nice meeting, and it's stronger today than it was 10 years ago. It's a nice meeting. People sometimes really get after each other intellectually in a absolutely free-for-all good way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah. All right, well, let's shift gears and sort of wind up. The changing definitions of addiction that you've witnessed, could you talk a little bit about how the definition of addiction has changed over the time that you've been involved in the field, where it is now, and what you think of where it is now?
Yeah.
Right, so if we're talking about a chronic relapsing brain disorder, is that a good, stable definition, or do you see trouble within it?
Yeah. I don't care a lot for big changes in definitions of things over time. They're largely because there's enough for everybody to chew on. It's a complicated problem. It's multifaceted for sure. And there's enough for to keep epidemiologists from hunger strikes, and enough to keep all of us busy. And as long as everybody is working very hard on the problem, what difference does it make what today's administrator, how today's administrator or regulatory agency wants to define the problem? it's obviously going to be a continuing problem, and if some people see it in one part of the brain as opposed to something that is a brain behavior, history, genetic, situational problem, I don't care. As long as the current definition doesn't squeeze somebody so much that they hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Mm-hmm.
And every part of the science of studying it to the point where you have a solution, if we ever find one, or 14 solutions. We need to support all we can about it. It is a problem that requires a plurality of disciplines.
It's a very nice place to end, unless you think of anything else.
Okie doke. That was fun.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.